All right, Matthew chapter 12. We're definitely going to get the lecture done today. I'm going to hope to get into the one we were going to do tomorrow. Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 11, we've been contrasting the kingdoms. We have been contrasting the kingdoms, the way in which the kingdom of the Jews' perspective functions, the way in which Jesus' kingdom is meant to function. We talked about the yoke last time, the yoke of which probably stood for what? When Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light." What is yoke probably referring to? So I referenced last week. Say it again. Yes, we talked about four different passages from Josephus and three from the Sibylline oracles that referenced yoke in the context of Rome's political dominance or Rome's political program. And I agree with Warren Carter on this, and I would argue that the way in which yoke is being used here is to say, take my political program on you. Become, submit to the authority of my kingdom. Because you're always submitting to an authority of some kingdom. He says, submit to the authority of my kingdom because my political program is light. My burden is easy. And of course, people could argue with Jesus about that, but well, that's another story for another time. Chapter 12. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some grain or some heads of grain and eat them. Were they stealing? No, that's not the issue here. How do I know they weren't stealing? Say it again. What was that? Deuteronomy what? And what does Deuteronomy 23 tell us?
You can eat your neighbor's grain.
Yeah.
And don't only with your hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can't go and take a sickle and start harvesting and be like, sweet, free grain. Like, no, it's you're walking by and grab it. Matter of fact, the edges, we talked about this, that the edges of the fields were actually commanded not to be harvested so that four different groups, now this is the second time I'm saying this, so that four different groups would have an opportunity to actually have some food. What were the four groups? Orphans, widows, aliens, and the poor, exactly right. Those are the four groups. So the actual outsides of the grain fields were not even supposed to be harvested. So the issue is definitely not stealing here. The issue is articulated in verse 2. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." How many categories of Sabbath restrictions are in the Pharisaic oral traditions? 39. 39 categories. And we talked about some of the different categories. The categories themselves would then be dialogued by this rabbi and this rabbi and this rabbi and this rabbi, even including down to you're not allowed to separate two threads on the Sabbath because that takes way too much time. And actually, it's pretty difficult. Don't know if you've ever tried that. But I consider that work. Okay. Verse 3. He answered, "Haven't you read?" Does that make no one else chuckle? I mean, who's Jesus talking to? Yeah, the Pharisees, a.k.a. teachers of the law. And he says, haven't you read? And then he references the Old Testament. Whoa, what a jerk. Ah, just kidding. Just kidding. I like it. I was praying then. Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Okay, if you haven't read it, we're going to read it. That way, you can actually answer Jesus' questions in the affirmative. 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 through 6, is what the story that Jesus is referencing here. 1 Samuel 21, 1 through 6. It says, David went to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. Now, David right now is on the run. Who's he running from? Old Testament scholars, yeah? Saul. Saul's gone a little crazy. David's been anointed king by Samuel, and Saul's like, I will not have it. He's going to kill him. So David's running. He goes to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king charged me with a certain matter and said to him, No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place." "Now then, what do you have in hand?" David asked him. Give me five loaves of bread or whatever you can find. But the priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. Did you hear that? He doesn't have any what on hand?
Ordinary
bread. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women. David replied, indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's bodies are holy even on mission that are not even on a mission, even on missions, that's what it is. I mistyped that. That are not holy. How much more so today? So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now you have read it. What is the issue here? Why is Jesus referencing this story? Because it was the first one that was on his mind?
Just because, like, they held David in such, like, high earlier that he's saying even, you know, your awesome king did
something. Yeah. He's putting them in a little bit of an awkward situation, isn't he? He's saying, you guys are looking for this big, bad king of David to come be the Messiah. But then you look, I'm claiming to be that person, and you're saying because my disciples are eating little things of grain, not even bread, little things of grain, and you're saying they're doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath because they're doing work. But what did David do on the Sabbath? What did he do on the Sabbath? It wasn't even just the Sabbath. It wasn't even just grains, little grain heads. It was the consecrated bread set aside for God that only the priests were allowed to touch and eat. Matter of fact, that's what he goes, let's read Leviticus 24. It says, this is talking about that particular bread. It says, take fine flour and bake 12 loaves of bread. Is that an accidental number? I don't think so. Using 2/10 of an ephah for each loaf. Set them in two rows, 6 in each row, on the table of pure gold before the Lord. Along each row, put some pure incense as a memorial portion to represent the bread and to be an offering made to the Lord by fire. This bread is to be set out before the Lord regularly, Sabbath after Sabbath, on behalf of the Israelites as a lasting covenant. Are you getting how important this bread is, the meticulous detail? How many are there? 12. Why the number 12? Yes, it's pointing to the tribes of Israel, and this is symbolizing this whole big ordeal. Setting before the Lord as an offering by fire is all done as a lasting covenant. This is covenantal bread. Sabbath after Sabbath, this is to be done. Leviticus 24:5-9 continues, and it says, it belongs to Aaron and his sons, who are to eat it in a holy place, because it is a most holy part of their regular share of the offerings made to the Lord by fire. This is not ordinary bread. This is bread that symbolizes the covenant that only belongs to the priests. And we know how serious in the Old Testament God takes His ritual laws, correct? And yet, on the Sabbath, whenever David was in need, what was the more important issue? What was the more important issue? What is Jesus getting at? Yeah, providing for the one that's in need. Yes, Williamson. Jesus, or David, references the day. How much more so today? And I believe that since the consecrated bread, I don't believe that consecrated bread was allowed to leave the Sabbath. I believe it needed to be devoured the day that it happened, correct?
Didn't they say they replaced it?
Say that again?
Didn't they say they replaced it?
Who said they replaced what? I'm sorry, I you could be right. I just don't know what you're referencing.
The Sabbath, the first 2 weeks, not day.
Yes, that's true, yeah. But what I'm saying is I don't believe the bread was allowed to last outside of the Sabbath.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he references the day in the middle. How much more so today? David says that to Ahimelech. So, yep. Good question. Keep going. So implicitly what Jesus is doing is this. He's saying, you're looking for this mighty David to come in the future, and yet you're holding me, I'm claiming to be that, and you're holding me to standards that David himself was willing to violate for a greater purpose. You see what he's doing? He's pitting them up against the one in which they are heralding. So will they be bold enough to say that David was wrong? Will they be bold enough to say that David is wrong? Probably not. Yes?
Were there consequences in the Samuel passage for David eating that bread?
Oh, no. Actually, that's exactly what should have happened. No, there were not consequences. It was actually... No. And I think that's what Jesus is referencing. The exact thing that was supposed to happen with that bread did happen. Okay, verse 5. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent? What does that mean? Help me exegete that. Is that right? What Jesus just said. He asked it as a question. Is it true that the priests desecrate the Sabbath every single Sabbath? Those of you training to be ministers, is your Sabbath the same as other people's Sabbath? If you haven't learned that yet, that's an important lesson. Because you will realize very quickly that Sunday is not a day to relax. It's just not. We don't get to relax on Sundays. Not the way it happens. Sunday is a work day. It's actually one of the most difficult work days. Why? Because like the priests of old, that's when the ministers work, on the day of the Sabbath. The priests do their most of their work on the Sabbath. Are they violating the laws of God then? Do you see what he's doing? He's saying, we claim that they are innocent, but they're working on the Sabbath. So, this is kind of the eschatological problem Jesus is also putting up against them. The Pharisees believed that in order for the exile to end, what needed to happen? What were the Pharisees doing with all their laws? What were they trying to accomplish? Yes, purity, absolute purity. Because they believed, and the prophets told us, that the reason why they went to exile to begin with was because of their rebellion against God. And the heart of the Pharisees is to make sure the people are pure so that the eschatological road can be paved for the King of David to once again come. Okay? So what Jesus asked them is this. But if the priests are violating the law every single Sabbath, how can we claim them to be innocent and not also suggest that God has built in a self-perpetuating, self-defeating system? In other words, your eschatological hope could never come true if I'm playing by your rules. If I'm playing by your rules, that we have to reach absolute purity, all of Israel, in order for the Messiah to come back, he will never come back because the system itself has violations in it. Verse 5 into 6. I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. Hey-o! Why is that a big passage? Yes, he did say that, but why would that be explosive?
Because they held the temple in such high regard.
Yes, they did, and for what reasons?
It was the house of God.
It was the house of God. What else?
They thought that if the temple wasn't there, God wasn't with them.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. That's definitely true. Because the temple literally, and I love the way N.T. Wright describes this, the temple literally is where heaven and earth intersect. It is the place where heaven and earth intersect because the actual dwelling of God dwells in the Holy of Holies. It's where the heaven and earth intersect, which that should say something whenever Paul says, so you are the temple of God now. You are where heaven and earth intersect, being indwelled by the Holy Spirit itself. The temple was pretty important because it distinguished them as the chosen people of God. It is the actual place where God and earth intersect. It is also where all of ritual purity rested. For all ritual purity, all of it ended up tracing its way back, like all roads of ritual purity end up in Jerusalem. They end up at the temple. And for Jesus to come and say that one is greater than the temple, what is he saying? He is saying all ritual purity is found in me. He's saying that the intersection between heaven and earth is actually more fully found in me. He's saying, I really am Emmanuel. That God with us thing really makes sense with me. I'm greater than the temple. Everything you hope for in the temple is me. People won't be surrounding the temple in the eschatological day of the Lord. They'll be surrounding me. Jesus is greater than the temple, which to them would be blasphemous because he's claiming to take the place, the key place where heaven and earth intersect, where God dwells with his people. And he's saying, I'm better than that. Those are pretty big words. Verse 7. If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. Where do I get that passage in the Old Testament? What is that? Hosea 6, 4 through 6. Let me read. God speaking to Israel. He says, what can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? Now listen to what he says to them. Your love is like the morning mist, like the early dew that disappears. Why is he upset with them? Why is he upset with them?
Small attention span.
Small attention span in regards to their love. They're not loving people right. They're not looking through the eyes of mercy and of grace and of love. That's what God is condemning them in Hosea 6 for. Does that sound similar to what Jesus is getting upset with the people, the Pharisees here? Does it? Hopefully it will as we finish today. Therefore, Hosea 6, 4, or I think we're in 5 now, but therefore I cut you in pieces with my prophets. What's his sword? Words, truth. I killed you with the words of my mouth, he says. My judgment flashed like lightning upon you, for I desire mercy, not sacrifice, an acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. In other words, what he's saying is this. The ritual purity is only a means to an end. The reason why I've lined out all of these ritual things is so that you draw closer to my heart. But once you get closer to my heart, you will realize that the sacrifices themselves mean nothing. They mean nothing. For what he truly desires is their love for people, for him. That is moving away like the morning mist. It is their love that is disappearing like the early morning dew. Let's couple this with another Old Testament passage in Micah. Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8 says this. I love this passage. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? That's an important question. What can we honestly offer in worship to the God of all creation? That he's like, wow, thank goodness you gave me that. Shall I? Whoa, sorry. I thought it was a voice of God. Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. Too much coffee. We're okay. Okay. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. That's a cool passage. Because it starts going through all these rituals and it says, what if I pile thousands of these up? Is this what he wants? What does he want from me? Does he want my firstborn child? Is that what he wants? Will that satisfy the God of all creation? And finally, Micah says, no. You know what he wants. What does he want? He wants you to act justly, to fight for the oppressed, for the least of these, to love mercy. Quit lusting after vengeance, but look forward to giving forgiveness and to walk humbly with your God. To realize, recognize who you are in comparison to Him. To shut your mouth, sit down, and just sit at His feet. And let Him tell you when to walk, let Him tell you when to sit, let Him tell you when to move, let Him tell you when to just sit still and be quiet. That's what God wants. That's what all the rituals point us toward. And that's what the Pharisees are flat out missing. They don't get it. And Jesus says, I love it how he says this. If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. It would have made sense to you. But because you don't even know what those mean, tells me you're not even looking through the lens that you need to look through, which is the lens, the eyes of God, the spectacles of the King. You're not even looking through those. And as a result, you have no idea what you're saying whenever you're condemning my disciples for picking grains of grain heads on the Sabbath. You're missing it. Verse 8, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Son of Man, what kind of reference is that? King, Daniel 7. And He is the one. This is what I love about this. And this is something that critiques the philosophical understanding of God versus the theological one. And I've talked about this recently in conversations, but philosophy says that God is immutable, unchangeable. And the reason why, the logic is because the definition of perfection means that you are absolutely perfect, that everything you do is an absolute balance, the best way it could possibly be. It is perfection. Therefore, if you find that perfection balance, you can't move from it. Because if you move from it, then you would be saying that you weren't in the state of perfection before. Right? Therefore, the logical conclusion then is that this God figure must be immutable, unchanging, cannot change, because He has to rest in the state of perfection. But what this verse says to me right here, that when Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath, the way I take that and bring it over here and say, no, God is also the Lord of perfection. Therefore, wherever He moves, the definition of perfection follows Him. Big difference. He's not bound to the definition of perfection. The definition of perfection is bound to Him. Same thing with the laws of the Sabbath. The laws of the Sabbath, they can be redefined if Jesus wants to. Why? Because He's King over the laws of the Sabbath. He's the one that decreed Him. He's the one that can mold them. He can change them, break them, remove them. He's Lord of the Sabbath. And as Lord of the Sabbath, He probably has a different perspective on all the ways in which the laws of the Sabbath intersect than what we do. Verse 9, going on from that place, He went into their synagogue. Oh. So they have a little bit of a conflict. And Jesus, in the verse, very next verse, Matthew says, let's take this to their turf. Synagogues could be in any city that had 10 Jewish males present. You had to have 10 Jewish males. 10 Jewish males present in order for a synagogue to be established in a city. Synagogues were established as places of worship outside of Jerusalem. Because whenever whenever the people of Israel went into exile, how do you worship God at the temple whenever the temple's been destroyed? Well, synagogues. Pharisees, their stomping grounds were the synagogues. The Sadducees' stomping grounds was the temple in Jerusalem. We'll keep hammering over that in the next couple of chapters. But Jesus is walking onto the Pharisees' territory. Verse 10, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked Him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? With the question and the presence of the man with the shriveled hand, we realize that on this day in the synagogue, it was not a day of worship, it was a battlefield. Because a man with a shriveled hand is planted, and the question of the Sabbath has just been presented to see. Because they're saying, okay, you desire mercy and not sacrifice. Let's see you put this into action publicly in front of everyone. Here's a man with a shriveled hand. Don't you have mercy on him? See the challenge that they're offering? Can you heal this man if you're so merciful? Will you do it on the Sabbath, O King of the Sabbath? Because if Jesus is blaspheming, the concept is that He would not be able to do the miracle. But Jesus uses miracles to validate His words. Verse 11, He said to them, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? There are actual caveats inside of the Pharisaic laws of the Sabbath that if some of your personal property, like a sheep, would fall into a pit, you were allowed to get it out even though it was actual work. Why? Because they didn't want you to lose money just because the Sabbath laws were in place. And so Jesus says, so let me get this straight. You're asking me whether or not it is lawful for me to heal someone, to restore their physical, sociological, and maybe even spiritual vitality. You're asking me if that's lawful, and yet you look at a sheep and you say, if that's going to make me lose money, that is lawful to do whatever work it takes to get it out? Okay, I'm just making sure we understand what we're asking here. And then he moves on and he says, how much more valuable is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. What Jesus is doing is this. He's saying your definition of the word good in your kingdom is much different than the definition of good in my kingdom. You say it is good to protect your wallets, to protect your prestige, to protect your honor. And I'm saying that it is good to do mercy, justice, and faith, and be faithful to God in that way. Then, verse 13, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. Now notice the contrast of the kingdoms. The definition of good comes on full display in verse 14. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill him. Remember chapter 11? How did Jesus say that the kingdom until now has been advancing? Violently, by violent men. He's saying, look at the kingdoms. They are different. How they define good is that even if it means killing someone in order to preserve the purity of their people, they will do it. They will do it. And he's saying, but what I'm saying is that the laws you need to violate, like, is not the do not murder ones. It's the love people so lavishly that it hurts. That it even puts your spiritual purity in jeopardy because you love them so stinking much. Different political systems. 6 minutes, yes. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. Many followed him, and he healed all their sick, of course, warning them not to tell who he was. Warning them not to tell who he was. Do not reveal my identity. And then irony sets in verses 17 through 21, because this parallel, or this passage from the Old Testament specifically is intended to reveal his identity. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love in whom I delight. Where have we heard that before? Baptism. Yes, baptism, Matthew chapter 3. I will put my spirit on him. Now we know why it was in chapter 3. And he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not even break. And a smoldering wick he will not even snuff out. Until he leads justice to victory. And in his name the nations will put their hope. You will need to know that for the test, that comes from Isaiah chapter 42, verses 1 through 4. But notice what that reveals. It reveals who Jesus is. It reveals the political program and the ultimate fate of his kingdom. Who is he? He is the servant whom God has chosen, the one in whom God delights, the one on whom God puts his spirit. And then what is his political program? To proclaim justice to the nations. Not to go around and to start destroying things. Like whenever there's a bruised reed, even a bruised reed, one that could be broken and nobody would think any different, he wouldn't break. Even a smoldering wick, one that's almost put out, he will not snuff out. That's not his purpose. What is his purpose? To lead people to victory. And ultimately, the fate of the kingdom is that in his name the nations put their hope. Can you ask me after class? We got 4 minutes, and I want to get into the next text. Sorry. Verse 22, then they brought him a demon-possessed man who was blind and mute, and Jesus healed him so that he could both talk and see. I just think that's really funny. That the blind and deaf Pharisees bring to Jesus this blind and deaf man. He heals them so that the man can go away seeing and talking. All the people were astonished and said, could this be the son of David? This entire section is going to be overly emphasizing the conflict between the four kingdoms that we've already described. Number one, the kingdom of Satan. The fact the man was demon-possessed and Jesus goes after and sets him free says that there is fighting between the two kingdoms, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. I want to read this. This is awesomely interesting. The Roman Empire is attacked directly by the fact that a blind and mute man is coupled with a man with a shriveled hand in a miraculous account. And where I get this is from Tacitus Histories 481. It's describing Vespasian, the first king of the Flavian dynasty that took over in 70 after the year of the three emperors and after the destruction of the temple. This is the very first one of this new dynasty of Rome called the Flavian dynasty. It'll be Vespasian, his son Titus, and his son Domitian that make up that entire dynasty. This is, though, an event that is described by Tacitus in Histories 481 about Vespasian. This is awesome. During the months with which Vespasian spent at Alexandria, waiting for the regular season of the summer winds to ensure a safe voyage, there occurred many miraculous events manifesting the goodwill of heaven and the special favor of providence towards him. At Alexandria, a poor workman who was well known to have a disease of the eye, acting on the advice of Serapis, whom this superstitious people worship as their chief god, fell at Vespasian's feet, demanding with sobs a cure for his blindness, and imploring that the emperor would deign to moisten his eyes and eyeballs with the spittle from his mouth. Another man with a maimed hand, also inspired by Serapis, besought Vespasian to imprint his footmark on it. Did you hear what he asked for? He has an impaired hand and he says, please step on it. That's really what he asks. But it's very poetically said. Besought Vespasian to imprint his footmark on it. At first Vespasian laughed at him and refused. But they insisted, half fearing to be thought of a fool, half stirred to hopes by their petition and by the flattery of his courtiers. He eventually told the doctors to form an opinion whether such cases of blindness and deformity could be remedied by human aid. The doctors talked round the question, saying that in the one case the power of sight was not extinct, and it would return if certain impediments were removed. In the other case, the limbs were distorted, but could be set right again by the application of an effective remedy. This might be the will of heaven, and the emperor had perhaps been chosen as the divine instrument. They added that he would gain all the credit if the cure were successful, while if it failed, the ridicule would fall on the unfortunate patients. Well, there's a win-win situation here presented before Vespasian. For if he cures the deformities, if he cures the blindness, well, then all the credit's his. If he fails, well, it's their fault. Awesome. This convinced Vespasian that there were no limits to his destiny. Nothing now seemed incredible. Nothing now seemed incredible. To the great excitement of the bystanders, he stepped forward with a smile on his face and did as the men desired him. Immediately the hand recovered its functions, and daylight shone once more in the blind man's eyes. Those who were present still attest both miracles today. Why would all of a sudden, right after the situation with the man with the shriveled hand, would this account pop up of a blind man being brought to Jesus? Is there a little poke, poke, nudge, nudge? Hey, remember Vespasian claimed to have done this? Remember when Jesus actually did this? Remember how Vespasian was like, ooh, can I get credit? And how after Jesus heals, he says, I don't want the credit. No one tell this about me. Remember how he was like, hey, can this be cured by human aid? And the doctors were like, yeah, actually, all this guy really needs is just stuff removed. And that guy, if it's just set right, it can work out. And he's like, all right, good. Interesting. Another kingdom in conflict. The Jewish kingdom is also in conflict here because the people just asked, could this be the son of David? Right after two accounts of conflict, which would have made the Jewish leaders be all of a sudden be like, oh no, he's bringing another kingdom which could collide with mine. Ultimately, this is going to be all about collision of kingdoms. We will talk about it next Tuesday. I love you guys. Thank you for being patient with me and being gone tomorrow. Have a good weekend.